Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Fresh airstrikes in Yemen. A Saudi-led coalition launched new airstrikes in Yemen on Wednesday, hours after announcing a halt to a month-long bombing campaign. The air raids hit Houthi rebel positions in the central city of Taiz and in the southern port of Aden as ground fighting between rebels and supporters of exiled President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi continued in both areas. In Taiz, the rebels seized control of a military brigade headquarters from forces backing Mr. Hadi before an airstrike hit the area. On Tuesday, Saudi Arabia declared an end to its bombing campaign aimed at halting the advance of the Houthis, but said its new focus on supporting a political solution could also include actions to prevent the rebels from acquiring or using weapons from Yemen's military. The rights group Amnesty International called on European leaders Wednesday to launch a humanitarian effort to end the spiraling tragedy of migrant shipwrecks in the Mediterranean. In a report released in Paris, it called the maritime disasters Europe's sinking shame. Amnesty urged the European Union heads of state meeting Thursday in Brussels to immediately authorize a humanitarian operation with more ships, aircraft, and other resources to patrol the Mediterranean, rescue at-risk migrants. European authorities continue to investigate how a migrant boat bound from strife-torn Libya to the southern Italian island of Lampedusa capsized a few days ago, with as many as 900 people drowning and only 28 rescued. European Union has come under mounting criticism for failing to develop an adequate response. This is VOA News. More than 3 months after the Paris terrorist attacks, French authorities say they foiled yet another plot, this time targeting one or more churches near the French capital. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA.
France's Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says police have arrested a 24-year-old French-Algerian IT student who's suspected of being an Islamist extremist. The man was taken into custody on Sunday. It's not immediately clear why the authorities made the announcement on Wednesday.
Dimanche matin à Paris, dans le 13e arrondissement, la police a découvert dans le véhicule.
Cazeneuve says police discovered an arsenal of weapons in his car parked in a Paris neighborhood. He said they also discovered documents showing the suspect allegedly planned on carrying out an attack on one or two churches in the Paris suburb of Villejuif. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The European Union charged Russian energy giant Gazprom with antitrust violations Wednesday, in a move that could further aggravate tensions between Russia and the EU. EU Competition Commissioner Margrethe Vestager announced the formal charges a week after mounting a similar challenge to U.S.-based internet search engine Google. She said Gazprom abuses its dominant position in Central and Eastern European countries, where it almost fully controls the gas market. Vestager said all companies that operate in the European market must play by EU rules. The leaders of Japan and China met privately Wednesday at the Asia-Africa Conference in Jakarta, but it is not clear if they moved any closer to resolving their difference over Japan's past wartime aggression. VOA's Brian Padden reports.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Chinese President Xi Jinping met for about half an hour on the sidelines of a leaders' summit in Indonesia. The meeting could be a sign that the two sides may be willing to begin a dialogue to resolve their differences over China's concerns that Japan is trying to rewrite history and exonerate itself from World War II atrocities. Afterwards, Mr. Abe told reporters they agreed to work for better relations. Next week, Mr. Abe will travel to the United States and address a joint session of Congress. His speech will be closely watched to see if and how he addresses the sensitive issue of Japan's wartime past. Brian Padden, VOA News, Jakarta.
Afghanistan's Taliban says it will launch its spring offensive on Friday, again demanding immediate withdrawal of remaining foreign forces from the country. The operations will target foreign occupiers, their permanent military bases, their intelligence, and diplomatic centers, the insurgent group announced in a statement emailed to VOA. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
tens of thousands of Ethiopians gathered Wednesday morning to mourn the 30 Ethiopians killed by Islamic State militants in Libya last weekend. The gathering ended with demonstrators throwing stones at the police and the crowd being dispersed.
That's Marta Vandewerf reporting from Addis Ababa. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, more than 60,000 people have fled their homes amid renewed fighting in the eastern DRC province of North Kivu in the past month. A rights group says anti-Balaka fighters in Central African Republic are holding more than 40 Muslim pole herders hostage. And political tensions are heating up in Guinea again, this time over the government's decision to postpone local elections until 2016. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, tens of thousands of Ethiopians gathered this morning to mourn the 30 Ethiopians killed by Islamic State militants in Libya last weekend. The gathering ended with demonstrators throwing stones at the police and the crowd being dispersed. Marta Vandewerf reports from Addis Ababa.
A demonstration in Addis Ababa to denounce Islamic State and mourn the group's killing of Ethiopians in Libya marked the start of a three-day mourning period in the East African country. Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn was among the officials and religious leaders who addressed the gathering. Tens of thousands of people gathered in the capital's main square and vowing to avenge the slaughter of their countrymen. Family members and friends of the victims were given special attention during the event. Ahazaika Sahai is the mother of one of the victims. She said she found out her child was killed when someone else told her they had seen her son on television. Ahaza's 38-year-old son left 2 months ago, saying he had found a job as a driver overseas. But the atmosphere changed when parts of the crowd began chanting messages directed at the government. People shouted things such as, "It's only here there is no government," voicing the dissatisfaction of many towards the government response not only to the Libya killings, but also to the lack of action to help Ethiopians caught up in the xenophobic attacks in South Africa. Authorities then dispersed the crowds, with police sometimes using sticks and firing a few rounds of tear gas to clear out the main square. Dozens were taken into custody, and some wounded demonstrators and police were taken to the hospital. Less than 2 hours later, everything was back to normal. A 31-year-old PhD student who wished not to be named had tears in his eyes looking at the scene Wednesday. He says he understands people's frustration because the Ethiopian government doesn't allow its citizens to express their feelings.
The first thing that the government should have to ask is that why people are migrating, why people are exiting from their country. There are a lot of challenges here. And just I want to ask the government to search what is the problem of the society to get out of their countries.
The beheading and shooting in the head of 30 Ethiopians in Libya, believed to be migrants trying to cross over to Europe, could be seen in a 29-minute video released by Islamic State on Saturday. Ethiopia has a long history of Muslims and Christians living peacefully side by side. Muslims make up about 40% of the population, according to government statistics, with followers of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church being the majority. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The European Union is to meet in emergency sessions tomorrow to consider 10 ways to stem the flow to Europe of migrants from many African countries and from war-torn Syria. The summit was called by Italy, which has provided most of the rescues on the Mediterranean so far. Amnesty International has called today for the EU to take emergency action. The human rights group says about 21,000 migrants have made the illegal and hazardous crossing so far this year. An estimated 1,500 died on the voyage. Ahead of the Brussels meeting, Italian Defense Minister Roberto Pinotti has argued for aggressive action to destroy vessels used by the smugglers. Pinotti says it's known where the smugglers keep their boats. The military action would be similar to the EU's anti-piracy project introduced off the Somali coast 7 years ago. Other proposals drafted by an EU executive committee include a larger budget for the EU's modest Triton Sea Rescue Program, assigning EU asylum officers to Italy and Greece to speed up fingerprinting and asylum applications, establishing a rapid return program for migrants who are refused residency, and sending EU immigration officers to Turkey and to Libya's neighbors, Niger, Tunisia, Morocco, and Egypt, to stem the migration flow. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the troubled Libyan government in Tobruk called for European aid in stopping the smugglers. Spokesman Hatim Al-Aribi said the smuggling operations bring in large profits for opposition militants and terrorists within Libya. Well, aid agencies say more than 60,000 people have fled their homes amid renewed fighting in the eastern DRC province of North Kivu in the past month. But the number of displaced people in the province is falling, and the government plans to close down several of their resettlement camps around the provincial capital, Goma. Nick Long reports from one of those camps.
Like thousands of other people, 62-year-old Justin Masudi and his family have been living in a tent at the Mugunga 3 camp outside Goma since 2008. Me and my family, we don't yet have a place to go back to, he tells VOA. My fields in Walikale, where I came from, have been occupied, he says. There are enemies there, and if I go back there, I shall be killed. So I'm staying here with the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. But, Masudi says, nearly 60% of people in the camp now want to go home, and others, including himself, would be willing to go elsewhere, to another town besides Goma, for example. When it closed down camps in the past, the government offered residents only two options, either to return home or integrate in the community around the camp. But in recent months, a third option is increasingly talked about, going somewhere else that is not where the displaced person came from. This is known as reinstallation or regrouping, and it's been endorsed by DRC President Joseph Kabila, who has said it should help to modernise living conditions for people in rural areas. It's an option that the UN Refugee Agency supports. The agency has been asking the 17,000 displaced people around Goma where they want to go when the camps close.
Environ 50% des déplacés veulent s'installer ailleurs.
50%, says Patrice Ahuansu, a field officer for UNHCR, want to be reinstalled elsewhere, including only 2% who want to be reinstalled in Goma, and 46% want to go home. Ahuansu showed VOA a map indicating where displaced people want to be resettled. A large majority preferred towns close to Goma. VOA informally polled about a dozen people at Mugunga 3 camp. About half said they could go home, and most of the others said they could reinstall if certain conditions were met. If I can just have a bit of help, I could reinstall, says this man, Andre Hangi. And asked what type of assistance he was looking for, he says help to build a little house. Justin Masudi says he has signed up to be reinstalled, but he'll need transport and some rations for a while, and he has no house where he's going. But he says if the refugee agency gives him a kit, including a tent, he can manage to build his own house. He warns, however, that in the past, some displaced people who left the camps did not receive those kits. For others, reinstallation will be more difficult. This man is saying he can reinstall if his father agrees. His father is in poor health, he says, and cannot walk up the hills in this mountainous area. The authorities will have the last word on where people can go, says official Chantal Kambibi.
It's for the government to decide, she says, where there is sufficient infrastructure, schools, health centres and so on, for people to be reinstalled. Aid workers warn that proper planning and funding for reinstallation or returns to the villages still needs to be guaranteed, especially for the many elderly and vulnerable people currently living in camps. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A rights group says anti-Balaka fighters in Central African Republic are holding more than 40 Muslim pole herders hostage. Human Rights Watch says most of the captives are women and girls who are at risk of sexual violence. The group is calling on the government and UN peacekeepers to free them and warns there are reports that many others are being held. The crisis in CAR began in early 2013 when Seleka rebels toppled the government. Anti-Balaka militias first arose to counterattacks on Christians by the Seleka. The militia soon targeted Muslim civilians, including the pole. Louis Mudge is Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. From the Rwandan capital, Kigali, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The Pole are an ethnic group of migratory herders who travel in the Central African Republic. They travel all the way to Senegal in West Africa and down to the Oriental province in the Congo. They move with their cattle and they are predominantly Muslim. They're broken up into many different groups to many different countries, but the Pole we're talking about now are Pole known as Imbororo, and these are Pole from the Central African Republic.
So who exactly is being held and where are they being held?
As you may remember, in late 2013, militias known as the Anti-Balaka started to rise up against the Seleka rebellion, and they turned their vengeance on Muslim civilians. Now, they started to attack the Pole in large numbers in late 2013 and early 2014, and we documented those attacks. What we've just been able to confirm is what we started hearing last year in late 2014, that many Pole were actually held hostage by these anti-Balaka fighters. Now, we've only documented this in the southwest of the country, so that's north of the capital, Bangui, in the southwest quadrant. But we are very concerned that this might be happening throughout the country in other areas.
Now, you have eyewitness testimony about what has happened to some of the other Pole members who were captured by the anti-Balaka forces, is that right?
Yeah, last week I was in a Muslim enclave called Yaloke, where we spoke with a large group of Pole who had been released after 14 months of captivity. And what they had to say was truly shocking. Children, male children, were killed, some as young as 6 years old, by anti-Balaka fighters because they wanted to kill all the men. And women, some of the women were kept as sex slaves, which means they were raped routinely throughout their 14 months captivity. We spoke with one woman who was actually pregnant at the time. She had been raped by so many men that she didn't even know who the father was.
Now, Human Rights Watch is calling on the interim government and the UN peacekeepers to try to free them. How can they go about doing this?
We first documented this group of Pole. They came out of a village called Pondo, and we first documented this in December of last year. There are Pole who are getting out of these areas who are able to pass on information about other Pole who are still being held hostage. Now, we spoke with Pole out of villages called Mbaina, out of villages known as Gaga, and Betefio, and they told us about numerous groups of Pole. We've passed this information on to the UN, and the UN and the interim government have the capacity to approach these anti-Balaka and to urge them and oblige them to free these Pole that are being held hostage. It's really up to them to take this action, but the information is certainly available. You can find out where these people are held. It's a lot of hard work. But based on what we've recorded in terms of the conditions in which they were held, this is very urgent.
Now, at least a year or so ago, there were reports of, you know, ongoing violence in CAR. Some of those reports said that the Pole had supported the Seleka rebels in the attacks. Any truth to that?
Yes, there is, and it makes things very complicated. The fact of the matter is that the Pole, which are both the Imbororo from the Central African Republic and also a group of Pole known as the Imbarara from Chad, Pro men are oftentimes, especially in the eastern part of the country, aligned with the Seleka and are involved in attacks on civilians. We have documented this phenomenon, and it continues. I just spent 10 days in the east getting back last week, and this phenomenon certainly continues with Pol's attacking civilians. So this is not to excuse the action of all Pol. What we're concerned with is children being killed, women being held as sex slaves. These are, by any stretch, civilians, and these people are being held hostage by anti-Balaka fighters and seriously mistreated.
Lewis Mudge is Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. From the Rwandan capital, Kigali, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Well, political tensions are heating up in Guinea again, this time over the government's decision to postpone local elections until 2016. The opposition says it will keep protesting despite renewed calls for dialogue. Karim Kamara reports from Conakry that Guineans say they are tired of all the discord.
Protesters clashed with security forces Monday during what authorities said was an unauthorized demonstration in Conakry. At least three people were wounded and an unknown number were arrested. Hundreds arrested during a demonstration last week have been sentenced to 2 to 5 month imprisonment. One person was killed. The opposition said security forces fired live bullets, which the government denies. It is just the last episode in what has been a years-long standoff between the government and the opposition over election organization. Dozens have been killed and wounded in protests since 2012. Previous disputes have centered on the composition of the Electoral Commission and the company contracted to handle the technical side of voters' registration and vote counting. Guineans, even those who support the opposition, say they are losing patience.
Aujourd'hui, de la situation guinéenne, ce que moi je pense, moi je fais un appel à l'opposition.
Teacher Maria Masako says the current situation is unfortunate. She says the opposition does not seem to want dialogue. They did not trust the government, she says, but this is not a solution, and they are just being stubborn. The opposition rejected government delegation Monday.
Mon avis, celui-là ne devrait pas refouler ces gens-là. La solution pour lui, c'est de venir sur la table.
Conakry Dr. Mamoudou Camara says politics cannot cope with violence. That is what they could understand. Political extremism is not good, he says. Opposition leader says they will not negotiate until the government withdraws the current electoral timetable. That timetable sets the presidential polls for October and postponed local elections to 2016. Union of Republican Forces party leader Sidya Touré told VOA he believes the government wants to rig the presidential election.
Nous souhaitons avoir un dialogue qui aboutisse à quelque chose avec le gouvernement.
He says this is like a war. They cannot call for ceasefire before going to the negotiating table. He says we cannot negotiate until the Electoral Commission has stopped its current preparations. The international community has previously mediated deals between the two sides. Touré says the government has not kept its promises. The Electoral Commission says because of the Ebola outbreak, it cannot afford to hold two elections in 2015. But the opposition argues that the municipal elections are being overdue. The last ones were held in 2005.
Nous n'avons pas cessé d'appeler l'opposition à la table de négociation. Nous continuons à le faire. Un certain nombre d'initiatives sont...
Government spokesperson Albert Damantan Camara says the government goal is peaceful elections and it will not stop calling for dialogue. He says when you are sincere, you can come to the table without preconditions. The government says it does not control the Independent Electoral Commission or the electoral timetable. But university professor and political analyst Sori Jakite says the government and the opposition need to talk.
Le point de divergence entre eux, je crois, c'est par rapport à l'ordre des élections. Et moi,
he says it is better to go straight to the presidential elections because if the president's elected mandate expires this year, Guinea will have an illegal president and that will provoke more problems and could be dangerous for the country. Human rights organizations are calling for negotiations, as are vendors and businessmen. The opposition has called for more protests Thursday, this time nationwide. Karim Kamara for VOA News, Conakry.
24 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A diverse cross-section of leaders from countries including China, Iran, and Zimbabwe gathered at the Asia-Africa Conference in Jakarta today. China's leader outlined his nation's ambitious strategy to boost economies across Asia and Africa by building infrastructure and striking trade agreements. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Jakarta.
In the past month, China has outlined its plans for a new Silk Road that will invest billions of dollars in infrastructure projects such as roads, ports, train links, and pipelines across much of Asia, the Middle East, and on to Europe. The so-called One Belt, One Road plan also includes the development of a maritime trade route linking ports in China with those in Africa and the Middle East. The plan would boost China's already significant economic role in global trade while pledging to connect countries eager to expand their own economies. President Xi Jinping addressed delegations from over 100 countries, including many heads of state, Wednesday, saying Beijing would further relax tariffs on many imports from developing nations to help boost their economies. The president called his country's economic plan a win-win approach that will encourage trade and investment. Critics of China's development plan say the country's building projects will not adhere to the same safeguards on human rights and environmental protections as projects funded by institutions like the World Bank. The United States frequently puts conditions on foreign development aid that calls on recipients to improve transparency, fight corruption, or make progress on political or social rights. In his speech to the gathering Wednesday, Indonesia's President Joko Widodo said, "It's imperative that we build a new economic order that is more open to emerging economic powers." Indonesia is one of the 57 countries that applied to join China's new development bank known as the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank. Japan and the United States have not joined. The co-chair of the conference, Zimbabwe's 91-year-old President Robert Mugabe, called for reform of the United Nations, specifically the elimination of the UN Security Council's veto power, which is dominated by permanent members, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China.
One of the essential ingredients in doing so will be the strengthening of our unity in continuing to fight for a United Nations that recognizes all its members as equal partners.
Middle East leaders like Jordan's King Abdullah II called for solidarity in the fight against terrorism and extremist Islamic militant groups. He mentioned how the world rallied in support when Islamic State extremists killed two Japanese hostages and also a Jordanian pilot. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani also condemned in particular the Sunni militants fighting in Iraq and Syria. And he may have been referring to Saudi Arabia and other Sunni groups when he condemned the regional and international players that support these extremists. Saudi Arabia is also leading a military coalition to fight Houthi insurgents in Yemen that are reportedly receiving support from Iran. In his remarks, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe made brief comments expressing deep remorse for past war. He was referring to criticism, especially from China and South Korea, that he is trying to deny the extent of atrocities committed by the Japanese military during World War II. Most of the other leaders focused on trade between developing countries, more investment in infrastructure like roads, electricity, and ports, and other development issues. The leaders' summit at the Asia-Africa Conference ends Thursday and is expected to produce a new cooperative framework and bilateral trade agreements. Many of the leaders participating in the summit will also join in a procession in Bandung Friday to commemorate the original 1955 Asia-Africa Conference. Brian Padden, VOA News, Jakarta.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salee, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Salee goes in-depth with the Sierra Leonean president, Ernest Bai Koroma.
Join us and we'll be waiting for your calls Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on the Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Tens of thousands of Ethiopians gathered this morning in Addis Ababa to mourn the 30 Ethiopians killed by Islamic State militants in Libya last weekend. More than 60,000 people have fled their homes amid renewed fighting in the eastern DRC province of North Kivu in the past month. And a rights group says anti-Balaka fighters in Central African Republic are holding more than 40 Muslim bull herders hostage. Coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with European club football.
Kim, Europe's top club football tournament continues this evening with the French side Monaco at home against Juventus of Italy. And in an all-Spanish encounter, defending champion Real Madrid hosting city rival Atletico Madrid. Now, at stake this evening are berths in the UEFA Champions League semifinals. Real and Atletico played to a scoreless draw in the first leg, while Juventus beat Monaco 1-0 in the first leg in Turin on a 57th-minute penalty shot by Chilean midfielder Arturo Vidal. In action Tuesday, Barcelona and Bayern Munich both advanced to the semifinals. Spanish power Barca beat visiting French club Paris Saint-Germain 2-0 on first-half goals by Brazilian star Neymar. Barcelona won the series 5-1 on aggregate. And in Germany, Bayern Munich pounded Porto 6-1 to reach its fourth consecutive UEFA Champions League semifinal. Polish striker Robert Lewandowski scored two goals for Bayern as the five-time European champions overcame a 3-1 deficit from the first leg last week and advanced on a 7-4 aggregate. Thiago Alcantara, Jerome Boateng, Thomas Müller, and Xabi Alonso scored the other goals for Bayern. Jerome Boateng is the half-brother of Kevin Prince Boateng, who has represented Ghana in international competition. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us now for a look at some recent African goal-scoring highlights in Europe.
Sonny Diouf of Senegal, he scored for Stoke City. He got the equalizer, and Stoke went on to beat Southampton by 2-1. Didier Drogba doesn't play that often for Chelsea these days, but the Ivorian played the full 90 minutes in the big match in England at the weekend against Manchester United. Drogba helping the champions-elect Chelsea to a 1-0 victory. If I move across to Spain, a name we don't often mention, Samawa Mate of Mozambique. He scored one of the Levante goals in a 2-2 draw against Espanyol, so well done to him. And then back to the Ivorian, Sonny. It's a player by the name of Asame Ngukuri. He's only 18 years of age, and he made his full senior debut for Inter Milan in the Milan derby against AC Milan, and by all accounts had an outstanding game. When he was substituted after 67 minutes, he received a standing ovation from the Inter fans. So well done to Asame. So quite interesting that there's a player for the future, and Didier Drogba, of course, a player in the twilight of his career. But these two Ivorians capturing a lot of the imagination of African football fans at the weekend. Staying in Italy, Ishak Belfodil, a Algerian who plays for Parma, he was on target for his club in a 2-2 draw at Empoli. and another player who never seems to stop scoring. It's Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He's the Gabonese star who plays for Borussia Dortmund in Germany. He scored one of the three goals in the victory over Paderborn, and that was his 13th league goal of the season. Now, the Bundesliga, Sonny, it's definitely among the top five leagues in Europe. And for a player like Aubameyang to be scoring so consistently augurs well for Gabon, who, of course, are going to be the hosts of the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations. So they're the goal scorers, Sonny, from Africans across the major leagues of Europe.
David, you use the phrase champions elect to describe Chelsea Football Club. I know they have a lot of fans in Africa who are singing the blues as Chelsea heads toward a trophy in England. But how about a look at the current EPL standings for our VOA football fans?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, Sonny. I just cannot see Chelsea letting a 10-point lead slip. Jose Mourinho just doesn't do that sort of thing. And there are only six rounds left. They've played 32 games and they've got 76 points. Arsenal are second with 66 points. And then Manchester United and Manchester City are on 65 and 64 respectively. But, Sonny, in both cases, they've played a game more than Chelsea and Arsenal. That means a lot at this stage of the season. What the two Manchester clubs, of course, are chasing is third position. Because that, as we've said before on The Voice of America, is crucial in terms of the European Champions League. If you finish first, second or third, you qualify automatically for the group phase of the competition. But if you finish fourth, you have to go through a qualifying match. Now, English clubs normally surmount that obstacle, but nevertheless, you can get like a visit to Turkey, a visit to Greece, or some other place where the opposition can be awkward. And certainly the two Manchester clubs, United and City, will be very keen to get that third position. Liverpool are next, Sonny, with 57 points. Now, that's a seven-point deficit behind Manchester City, and that's a lot of catching up to do. Tottenham have also got 57 points, and Southampton, as far as I'm concerned, are out of it with 56 points. There is, of course, the consolation for those clubs finishing fifth and sixth. You can go into the Europa League, which is the second-tier European competition. Also interesting, Sonny, at the bottom of the table, right at the bottom, you've got Burnley with 26. You've also got Queen's Park Rangers with 26. They're second last because they've got a better goal difference. And then Leicester City, who just a few weeks ago looked done and dusted. They look doomed and down. They have suddenly put together a few victories. And they've got 28 points. And they're only in the bottom three. And the bottom three are the ones who get relegated, because Hull City have got a superior goal difference. So when we get to the end of the season, Sonny, I think Chelsea are going to have wrapped up the league with several matches to play. You have the two Manchester clubs fighting it out, probably for third place. And then we're going to have this really interesting battle at the bottom. Sunderland, Hull, Leicester, Queen's Park Rangers and Burnley. Those are the five I see fighting to avoid those bottom three positions.
Thanks, David. That's our football guru, David Legg. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, caught up with two of South Africa's top athletes, one the African champion in the shot put, and the other a Commonwealth Games bronze medalist in the long jump.
South Africa's Commonwealth Games long jump bronze medalist Rashwal Samai has set an ambitious target for the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China in August. His confidence soared following his win in long jump at the South Africa Senior Athletics Championships in Stellenbosch over the weekend.
The goal was to come to SH to jump 820 meters. Me and my coach, Zene Kingwell, and I surpassed 820 meters with 80 centimeters, so I'm good.
That means you came here knowing that you want to make your PB, because your PB previously was 8.13.
I never thought that I would jump 8.13, you know, but it happened. To God's protection and his glory and also the talent he gave me.
It's been a very interesting development for you from last year, making your Commonwealth bronze medal, making the Africa team for the IAAF Continental Cup. I guess that inspires you this year. In terms of distances, now I'm sure you're setting new goals for the year.
Goal this year was to qualify for World Championships, and also the goal since the beginning of the year was to get a medal at the World Championships, but I know for a fact it's not going to be easy. I know for a fact it's going to, through hard work and a lot of dedication, anything is possible. You know, with God, anything is possible, and I can do it.
And I'm sure that you've now set higher goals. You hope to improve on this distance sometime this year.
Yes, most definitely. I take each and every competition as an opportunity for me to, you know, increase my PB.
That is South African Rashwal Samai, the Commonwealth Games long jump bronze medalist, speaking in Stellenbosch, South Africa. Meanwhile, Orazio Cremona of South Africa aims to break new grounds at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China in August. He's inspired by his hard-fought national championship triumph.
It's like I don't think I've ever experienced something so intense since from world champ. All the credit goes to God. Thank you for all the talent he's given me. Thank you for helping me through everything. My family, my girlfriend, my coach, Joshua Capizzaria, coach, my other coach from Dup. Couldn't have done it together. It was a lot of hard work, but it came through at the right time. And I also like to congratulate Yaku, who made qualifying and a huge PB. It was absolutely amazing. One of the best competitions in South Africa I've ever had. The last three throws were absolutely amazing. 2049, 2036, and 2045. So I'm certainly happy.
This is your fourth national title. And also, you know, you're the Africa champion two times on the trot. Yeah, what goal have you for yourself for this year?
Well, you know, I just want to go overseas and do well at the World Championships. I want to try and make the top eight at the World Championships. That'll set me up nicely for next year's Olympics.
That was South Africa's Orazio Cremona, the Africa shot put champion. From Mark Ouma in Stellenbosch, Western Cape Province in South Africa.
Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 18.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner with VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 88.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. And more grease to the sporty elbows of you and your sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM staffs in Lagos, Abuja, as well as in Kaduna and Onitsha. Finally, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Mike Budenholzer, who was named the National Basketball Association's Coach of the Year. The 45-year-old Budenholzer led the Atlanta Hawks to a club record 60 victories during the regular season. The Hawks also soared to their first division title since 1994, and they're the top seed in the Eastern Conference in the NBA playoffs. Mike Budenholzer of the Atlanta Hawks, the NBA's Coach of the Year. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, the deputy chair of the AU Commission says a paradigm shift by African governments is key to unlocking the continent's growth potential. And a scientist raised in Eritrea now enjoys a prominent position in one of the world's leading space exploration initiatives. First, here's Teddy Afro of Ethiopia with Salemi.
Celebrate.
Teddy Afro with Saleme. Well, the deputy chair of the African Union Commission says the continent is making slow but steady strides in meeting the various targets outlined in the Millennium Development Goals set by the United Nations in 2000. Erastus Mwencha says Africa's growth potential lies in its human capital and infrastructure development. He urged governments to invest heavily in technology and education. Mwencha tells VOA's Ndumyake Mwakalyele that a paradigm shift by African governments is key to unlocking the continent's growth potential.
Africa is still struggling to climb up the ladder in terms of transformation. Africa has remained at the level of dependence on extractive industries. And that's why this growth is not inclusive enough, because extractive industries tend to have huge returns. But when you look at it, it is simply operations that are very narrow in terms of encompassing society. But the more you move up, particularly in terms of having broader service sector, having manufacturing sector, you start to see level of employment and involvement, because it also comes with more skills, education and the rest, and the economy becomes more sophisticated. So this is the challenge that Africa has, and that is the trick. In fact, when you talked of 18 and 25, that is the ratio of investment. At the moment, Africa, what we see is only 18% of GDP that is being invested. But you need, for transformation to take place, at least 25% of GDP to be invested. And any model that you have seen, a country that has broken the barrier from being a low-value economy to a higher-value economy, is you must invest. Invest in education, invest in infrastructure, invest in technology. And that is where Africa now must focus for its transformation.
But what is the stumbling block? Why isn't it at that point?
Well, I think if you listen to our presentation, we are saying it is happening, but the scale is not enough. And mind you, we need to say one thing here, that Africa is not a country. We are talking of aggregation now. If you unpack, you see a few, mind you, that if you are talking of 10 fastest growing economies in the world, majority of those will be found in Africa. Now, there are a few of them. And when you look at some of these, you unpack, you will find a few of these countries are those dependent on extractive industries. But you do have two, three of them, which are also now looking at issues of diversification of the economy. So unless we start to see diversification as part of the equation, this is where the trick is. Fortunately, this is now on the table. And in addressing them, particularly the investment gap, Africa said we must mobilize domestic resources.
Erastus Mwencha is the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. He spoke in Washington with Ndumyake Mwakalyele of VOA's Zimbabwe service. A top U.S. scientist involved with space exploration was raised in East Africa. Dr. Paul Mahaffey currently is the chief of the Planetary Environments Laboratory in the Solar System Exploration Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He's currently part of the team operating the Curiosity rover on the surface of Mars. Today, he enjoys a prominent position in one of the world's leading space exploration initiatives. But as reporter Salem Fakado tells us, he and six other siblings had humble childhoods in Eritrea. Salem Solomon recently spoke with him and two of his brothers.
Some of Paul Mahaffey's fondest childhood memories are of doing something that would make most parents today cringe. Living in the Red Sea nation of Eritrea, he would climb up a mountain near the town of Sen'afe. The granite formation known as Metara rises 2,500 meters above sea level, and at its peak sits a 30-foot iron cross erected decades ago by Italians.
I'd climb to the top of the mountain and then climb to the top of the cross. It was an iron cross, and sit there, and it was just the highest point around, and the wind would be blowing, and it was pretty amazing.
Perhaps it was from that high perch that Mahaffey first began to look at the Earth from a different perspective than his peers. Today, he is one of the top scientists at NASA, researching the soil and atmosphere of Mars and examining whether it has ever supported life. He has come a long way from an unusual childhood. How he got here is an interesting story in its own right. It begins shortly after World War II, when the Allied victory in Europe was announced in what came to be known as VE Day, May 8, 1945. Francis Mahaffey, an Orthodox Presbyterian pastor, and his wife Arlena decided to embark on a journey that would define their family's history. They boarded a boat bound for East Africa, where they had agreed to spend the next 20 years as missionaries. His brother, Peter Mahaffey, is a chemistry professor at the King's University in Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada.
My father was a language translator and pastor, and my mother was and is a lifelong teacher. And so all of the children in our family, there are seven of us, were born in Eritrea. And I think we all have a good bit of East African blood in our flowing through our veins and certainly in our hearts.
Their mother, Arlena, who is now 97 years old, had taught in one-room schoolhouse in Illinois. So it was not a difficult transition for her to begin teaching her seven children in the family's new home of Senafe, Eritrea. For the children, their days were filled with studying and their afternoons and weekends with childlike adventures. They climbed trees, played football with kids their age, and explored their surroundings.
My mother, bless her heart, always encouraged us to explore the world around us. And so each of us as children would just revel in the biodiversity in Eritrea, in discovering the amazing creatures that lived outside the village, whether that be laughing hyenas that came down during the night to quarrel with the village dogs or collecting scorpions to have as pets. So there weren't very many barriers put on our love of learning and discovery, and we were always also taught to be very responsible in what we did and to be safe.
Both of their parents made an impact on the Eritrean people. In addition to his work as a pastor, their father was among the first to document several of Eritrean native languages. Samuel Mahaffey is a consultant and author in Spokane, Washington, and one of Paul's six siblings.
So my father learned the Dankali language actually before he learned the Saho language, and he learned by being in a village on the coast of Eritrea and being immersed in the Dankali language. And he actually gave assistance to some other people working in languages in Eritrea, including in the Afar language.
Their mother, although not trained as a nurse, helped treat patients and obtain much-needed medical supplies. For Paul, the love of science would become a lifelong passion. In 1996, the family moved back to Chicago in the United States. He followed his older brother in Iowa, where he majored in chemistry and minored in mathematics. After that, he received a doctorate in chemistry from Iowa State. He had never focused on planetary science in his studies, but in 1979, when his wife took a job in Washington, D.C., he found a position at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Beginning in 1980, he worked on a project to build an instrument that would be parachuted into Jupiter to test the atmosphere.
And it was just fabulous. I mean, it was the first time, you know, we human beings had entered the atmosphere of a giant planet. Everything was new, you know. We can sense a little bit of what's there by spectroscopic means and so on, but there are certain things you just can't learn unless you go into an atmosphere and make measurements. We call it in situ.
More recently, Paul Mahaffey has been leading a team of 30 who are working on the Mars rover called Curiosity, one of the first spacecraft to land on the Red Planet. The rover is taking soil samples and atmospheric samples and sending data to satellites orbiting the planet, which in turn beam it back to Earth.
So we're really serving the advancement of our understanding of Mars, not just for this team, but for the public. It's there for the world to look at in the long run.
And although he has not been back to his country of birth, he believes part of his inspiration came from his youth spent in the highlands of Eritrea. He said the variety of vegetation and topography made it inspiring to explore the Earth and today other planets. He called Eritrea amazingly beautiful and diverse. Many scientists use the same words to describe the solar system. Salem Solomon in Washington, D.C.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 22nd, the United States observes Earth Day, an opportunity to reflect on the impact of humans on the Earth and to consider how we as individuals can ensure that our impact is positive. The first Earth Day was planned as a teach-in, a day to inform about environmental issues. Back in the late 1960s, people in the United States were increasingly worried about the deterioration of the environment, the lack of regulation of pollution, or the political will to do anything about it. One of them was Earth Day founder, United States Senator Gaylord Nelson, an environmental activist who was outraged by lack of political response to the gross environmental degradation perpetrated around the country. He said he was convinced that all we need to do to bring an overwhelming insistence on the new generation that we stem the tide of environmental disaster is to present the facts clearly and dramatically. Over 20 million people turned up for Senator Nelson's first Earth Day on April 22, 1970. And from then on, the movement grew spontaneously, creating its own momentum with no central directorate. Today, Earth Day is considered by many to be the birth of the modern environmental movement. It resulted in the establishment of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and passage of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act. Back in 1970, the focus was on oil spills, industrial polluters, toxic dumps, the loss of wilderness, and the extinction of wildlife. Today, the main concern has to do with climate change. There is little doubt that human activity interferes with the Earth's climate systems. An intergovernmental panel on climate change, which met in Yokohama, Japan last year, issued a report stating that change has already begun to affect crop yields and was driving recent killer heat waves and droughts, disastrous floods, and weather extremes. Unless we act dramatically and quickly, science tells us our climate and our way of life are literally in jeopardy, said Secretary of State John Kerry. No single country causes climate change, and no one country can stop it. But we need to match the urgency of our response with the scale of the science. The clock is ticking.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Take your peek. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali goes in-depth with the Sierra Leonean president, Ernest Bai Koroma.
Join us and we'll be waiting for your calls Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on the Voice of America.